Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show,
2,500 nurses and midwives, graduating nurses and midwives, haven't received jobs for next year. We want Victorians to get behind nurses and midwives.
Nurses rally in Melbourne today, calling for more support to prevent a shortage of graduate placements.
By everyone kind of understanding more, then we can be able to use a more common language.
New study reveals 1 in 5 children in Australia suffer from chronic pain. And later today,
sitting there, let's move with it. Let's get First Nation voices and faces on the TV airwaves.
We speak to the CEO of Ngada Media on their milestone TV digital channel launch this week. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Nurses and midwives rallied in Melbourne today, warning that 2,000 graduates could miss out on placements by 2026, despite ongoing staff shortages. During Nursing in the Community Week, they're calling for more support and reforms so nurses can work to their full potential, not just in hospitals, but in aged care, schools and homes. The Australian Nursing Midwifery Federation, ANMF, is urging the government to fund more graduate spots and is pushing its Use Us or Lose Us petition. The Wire's Yan Wang was at the rally today and spoke to ANMF Assistant Secretary Nicole Allen.
So the message we want to hear, we want Victorians to hear, is that 2,500 nurses and midwives, graduating nurses and midwives, haven't received jobs for next year. We want Victorians to get behind nurses and midwives in the state, get behind the healthcare system, back our nurses in. The workforce has got a shortfall, and so our graduates need a job. So what we want the government to do is look at all options, aged care, primary care, private sector. We want our public sector to offer more positions. We know that there's shortfalls in the workplace, offer more graduate positions to increase our workforce.
Yeah, and what would you say to the wider community about why it's important to back student nurses and midwives right now?
Yeah, the Victorian community can back our graduates. They can get online, sign a petition, contact their local member and support our nurses and midwives to get the jobs that they deserve.
I think the main message we really want to get from Nursing in the Community Week is that nurses who work in the community really make a significant contribution to the health and wellbeing of all Australians. Nurses make care available that complements the work that doctors and allied health do, and this means that there's more services available for people in the community to get health care when they need it and to keep them well, to keep them out of hospital. Nurses provide health education to people that helps people to understand their health and their health risks, and this really enables people to make informed choices about their health and healthcare. So nurses in their community and nurses where you need them.
You've also highlighted the success of nurse-led clinics and the role of nurses in Medicare urgent care clinics. How do these examples demonstrate the potential of nurses working to their full scope?
So nurse-led clinics really demonstrate that nurses have the skills and the knowledge to support people with a range of conditions to keep them well. So nurses can help people with providing health education, they can help assess and manage people's symptoms, and they can help people to look after their own health as well as identifying when they need to be referred to other providers. And while nurses in all of these clinics work in multidisciplinary teams, in the nurse-led clinics, the nurses are actually taking responsibility for their care that's within the practice scope. And that's the things that nurses are actually educated and trained to do. And this means that care is more efficient and connected for the people who need it.
So looking more broadly, what reforms would make the most significant difference in allowing nurses and midwives to provide more comprehensive care?
I guess the biggest barrier at the moment is the funding system. And the current funding system doesn't really support nurses to work to the full scope of practice. It doesn't support them to do the things that they're educated and trained to do. So in general practice, for example, nurses aren't funded to be able to provide some services that they're trained and educated to provide. And this means that general practitioners have to undertake the tasks because that produces remuneration that supports the business's viability. An example of that might be your immunisation or your wound care. Whilst a nurse could quite easily manage immunisation or wound care independently from a doctor, often they have to get the doctor to come in and see the patient because that's how they attract money to the practice. Delegating these tasks to nurses would be much more efficient use of time and would allow the GPs to then focus on those tasks that actually require a doctor to undertake. And whether we like it or not, healthcare is a business, and the remuneration that's provided by the government for services does need to cover the costs of running that business.
Vulnerable populations such as people in rural and remote areas and the First Nation communities and older Australians are often most affected by gaps in healthcare. Can you give us some examples of how expanding nurses' scope of practice could improve access to care for these groups?
So I think really it's not necessarily about expanding scopes of practice for nurses. Nurses already have the skills and expertise to be able to provide a range of care that the vulnerable groups need. Nurses often have a close relationship between the vulnerable groups because they're working in and with the communities, and they often can see the challenges of not only the individual patient they're caring for, but also the broader challenges that the community faces. And that can really help to provide care that meets the patient's needs in that community. Nurses can provide a range of things such as health promotion to help people to reduce their risk factors for disease, some self-management support to help people look after themselves and live well with chronic conditions, and as well as assessing and managing the symptoms people are experiencing them to keep them living well and living well longer. And nurses can provide access to care just simply by being in these communities and increasing the number of services that are available.
That was Professor Liz Holcomb from the Australian College of Nursing speaking to The Wire's Yan Wang. A new report reveals one in five Australian children live with chronic pain, but many face delays of up to 3 years before getting a diagnosis. This persistent pain, lasting longer than 3 months, disrupts several parts of children's life, from school, friendships and well-being. I spoke with Dr. Joshua Pate, senior lecturer at the University of Technology, Sydney, about why many children are facing a delay in diagnosis.
This has been our first opportunity at scale to kind of hear from Australian families about what these major barriers are. And I think, like, there's not just one, change to reduce waiting lists that will kind of patch it and fix it completely. But, yeah, there's a lot of different things, I guess, that can contribute. And for some, it's, like, not knowing about different care pathways and things. So, like, for instance, about a decade ago now, different pain clinics were set up in various hospitals throughout Australia. And these are pain clinics where there's like a pain specialist and a physiotherapist and a psychologist and a nurse and an OT, lots of different people all working together. And that has pretty good evidence behind it from at a global level. And so we started rolling those out, and it's kind of like, was quite a long time before the waiting list grew, and then now they're very long. And so there's this challenge of, like, when the evidence improves, then the demand increases, and then it's really hard to kind of play catch up. But I think at a kind of systemic level, there's some great tech solutions that are becoming more possible. So in these pain clinics, they run like telehealth opportunities for those in rural and remote communities. So there is a bit better access, and I think things like the internet and telehealth are allowing for improved access. But yeah, it's obviously needs more staff, and there's lots of those kind of logistical challenges too.
Chronic pain in children is often dismissed as, you know, growing pains or anxiety. What can healthcare professionals better do to identify chronic pain in children?
Yeah, so the word chronic or persistent pain, it just kind of means it's lasted longer than you expect. And so if someone has a good thorough assessment done by a health professional and basically, like, various different diagnostic labels could be given, and there are certain unique pathologies to kids, like children aren't just little adults. So once some of those major conditions are ruled out, then sometimes this diagnosis or this label of just saying, oh, well, it's chronic pain or it's a long-term pain gets given. And that's really hard, because if you go to Dr. Google or now Dr. AI with mm-hmm. some of these things, it can be really hard. And you're watching TV and there's ads trying to convince you to do certain treatments and quick fixes and things like that. So it's a really hard thing to navigate. And I would say, like, the first step would be getting a health professional that you trust and being okay with getting multiple different opinions. It's really hard to kind of advocate that there's like one perfect expert or there's one perfect system.
Speaking about the school system, what needs to happen for those services like schools, health services, to work with kids experiencing chronic pain?
Yeah, this is what my PhD was on, and one of my students who's just finished her PhD, we went into schools and provided the latest neuroscience to teachers and to the staff in the school systems. And this was a small pilot, but what we saw was 1 year later, following them up, that we saw like larger system change. It wasn't just like one dot point in the curriculum change, but there was an ability to, like, the whole of community approach seemed to be more empowering. So there were quotes like, pain's become less invisible in the playground, and kids feel more confident to help their friends and sit next to them and stuff like that. So I think there's not just like one approach that's going to fix everything, but there is work being done in different school systems already, but it's in its early stages for now. And I think by everyone kind of understanding more, then we can be able to use a more common language. Because what can happen is, say, like an 8 to 12-year-old or something like that is often when kind of chronic pain starts emerging. That child might be playing lots of sport and they have a coach who's very influential. And then they go to the school and they spend 40% of their awake life with their teacher who's very influential. And then they've got the parents who are very influential, and their siblings and those they admire, and the influences online or whatever it is. And so there's all these different people who are inadvertently, often it's unintentionally, providing health kind of influence.
Well, I guess to our listeners who are parents, how can they tell if their children are experiencing chronic?
So I guess you can ask them, and I guess it depends on the age whether they're able to tell you. But I think it's this tricky thing, because sometimes the language and the vocabulary isn't there to explain what's going on. I worked on a series of children's books actually to like kind of tackle this problem. And so people can get those in the library. They're called Zoe and Zach's Pain Hacks. And in those books, there's a character, and Zoe goes on this journey of kind of learning more about the neuroscience and finding out more about like the difference between when she's had a scraped knee and then when she's had this tummy pain that doctors have investigated. And so she kind of starts learning about when is pain helpful and when is pain unhelpful, and asking those curious questions. So I think there are resources out there now that can help. But yeah, I think getting alongside kids as a starting point and hearing what they have to say about it is probably the first thing.
That was Dr. Joshua Pate, Senior Lecturer at the University of Technology, Sydney, speaking to The Wire. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM, and to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3, and to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. An 8th person has been charged with murder following the deaths of 2 boys walking home from basketball in Melbourne. 12-year-old Chol Achik and 15-year-old Do Kweng were chased and attacked by machetes earlier this month in Melbourne's northwest. The tragic event sparking calls for tougher bail laws from the South Sudanese community. Sarah Jensen spoke to Akol Magot, a family friend of the 2 boys, who was at the scene the night of the attack.
It was very extremely bad, seeing 2 young people on the floor, dead, police all around them. We as a family sitting there, we can't know whether to rush to it, to uncover it and see them, or what's not. But it was shocking. It was shocking, and it was very tragic for us. It's unbelievable. That night, it was a horrible night. It's a night that changed our life forever.
When you say it changed your life, what's the impact it's left on the South Sudanese community?
A very negative impact, especially for the young people. You know, just losing their life easily like that. And for us as parents, the community, this is not what we intended to be in Australia for, to bring our young ones. Or they're even born here. Both of Chol and Dow, they were born here, you know, and seeing them just gone like that was something that they don't even have any part of it. It makes it very difficult, very challenging. Yeah, the impact is very negative. We've been crashed, you know, we're devastated. It's very hard for us to swallow that.
And how have the parents come together to support one another in this time?
All our community, even other communities, they are very generous. They came, they keep coming to the house for support. Since the day of the incident, both family been receiving a lot of support, physical support, emotional support, even financial support and spiritual support throughout the community. They keep coming. Even some of the government officials as well, they came to visit us, and it was amazing. It was good. You know, the support has been ongoing, and we're really appreciating it as well. Yeah.
And what can the wider community here in Melbourne do to help your community?
What the wider community can do is just to contribute in safety. If your child, your son or your daughter is on the wrong part of the law, is to encourage them to disengage, to encourage them to get back to the reality, you know, to be in a safe side. You know, because they deserve to be safe. They deserve, when they go out there, they can feel safe and come back home safe as well. And what we can do, all of us as a whole community in Victoria, is to encourage our young people not to partake in any wrongdoing or breaking the laws or carrying knives or machetes or guns or violence overall, because this is not helping us as a community regardless.
And what steps do you want to see taken by the government to keep, you know, the children safe from these communities?
The government would definitely can definitely do so much. They can first thing put a bit of investment into the Victoria Police and put a little bit of investment into the community services providers. You know, grant more spaces for young people to where they can feel safe, where they can feel welcome, where they can participate in their sports in different levels, in different fields. Open doors for more safety spaces throughout the community. Of course, to empower police just to carry on with their jobs, and overall to strengthen the bail laws as well, you know, because the problem now is not the police catching the criminals, because they could catch the criminals and then later on they get released in bail. So bail is the one that's killing us as a community. If you toughen the bail, then no one can commit any crime, because they will know that the rules are tough.
So you're asking for tougher bail laws to be implemented?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We want the bail to be more tougher, so that the message can come across to everyone who lives in Victoria, knowing that you break a rule, you break a law, you commit a crime, you get sentenced. I believe that Victoria is for all of us, you know. Everybody is deserved to be safe. Everybody deserves to be healthy. Everybody deserves to be happy. We are one community. It's no longer about race. It's no longer about color. It's no longer about gender. It's no longer about the religions. It's about us coming together as Victorians and who want to do good for Victoria.
Mr. Akol Magot from Wyndham Community, speaking to Sarah Jensen's For The Wire. This week, Nagata Media launched its TV digital channel, achieving a milestone for regional media organisations in the Pilbara. Nagata TV is now available through their app on iPhone or Android, and also on new digital TVs, celebrating culture, opening conversations and representing First Nations communities through a West Australian community lens. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked asked Chief Editorial Officer of Nagata Media, Tangora Hinaki, her thoughts about achieving this success for the organisation.
Kia ora, my name is Tangora Hinaki. I'm a Māori woman from the Eastern Tribes of Aotearoa, New Zealand. I'm the Chief Editorial Officer at Nagata Media in the Pilbara of Western Australia. I'm going to definitely be celebrating at the end of this week with my team. We'll probably go out and have a bit of a dance, but I am excited. When you see a project through to its fruition, you feel complete. You feel like, you know, you've worked hard to see that dream come true. And also to collaborate with Noongar Radio in Boorloo, Perth, and have Leon Khan be a Noongar presenter in the southwest is just the icing on the cake in regards to, you know, having a statewide footprint, having someone from the northwest, First Nations tribes presenting, and then also a Noongar person from the southwest is a dream come true.
Now, could you please tell us for our audience how Nagata TV was created and what's the purpose of it?
So Nagata TV was created because our founders, which was Tjulawalu Aboriginal Corporation, run by Lorraine Coppin, CEO, and her partner Michael Woodley, they already had a TV license that they launched at least 20 years ago, but it was called Jack, you know, which stands for Tjulawalu Aboriginal Corporation TV, Jack TV. And so NG Bundy stories were being played out at least 19 years ago when I moved to town in Roebourne, and I could get that on my TV in Roebourne. So we've got a multicast license. We've had it for years, and it's always been part of our strategic plan to, you know, not let it go to waste. It's sitting there. Let's move with it. Let's get First Nation voices and faces on the TV airwaves. However, being 2025, we thought we'd also take a modern approach and we would go the Nagata TV streaming app way, which is like Netflix or Stan, but you can actually download Nagata Television and look forward to, you know, our flagship program. So, you know, in regards to getting it started, my board said, look, Tangiora, we don't have funding for this, but just do it. Get it done. We used our own money to get the Nagata Television streaming platform up and running. We're partnering with a organisation in Texas. Obviously, they know what they're doing. And it's a really good platform that's easy to manoeuvre and schedule.
Now, how important is to bring to the audience the stories from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in WA in TV?
It's so important. You know, we've got our national broadcaster, NITV, and they, you know, they've got a big job to capture the voices of the nation. My board felt that as a growing media hub ourselves, Nagata Media, that does statewide news and films a lot of stories, that we are best placed, you know, to tell those stories from WA. And sadly, a lot of regional stories, not only in WA but around Australia, those voices aren't being captured and heard. And when we think about Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders making up 3% of our population across the nation, it is important that we've got our own media sector. It is important that we, you know, create platforms like the Nagata TV streaming app, because it means that mob have got 99.9% chance of having their stories heard. Because in this world that we live in, mainstream media, the ABC, not every story that is pitched to them makes it.
Now, how many programs are broadcasting on Nagata TV on this first phase? And if you can give us a little bit of an idea of what they are about.
Okay, so to be honest, our main program is our flagship program, and we've had to just rely on copyright-free programming. So at the moment, we've got The Couch, which is a West Australian Perth-based program that Foxtel actually take, which is a flex for WA. So that's a program that you can see right after our program called The First Nations Report.
Fantastic. My last question, where can people subscribe or watch Nagata TV, and what does the future look like for the project?
Okay, so Eduardo, what you need to do, you need to download Nagata Television. Download it to your iPhone, Androids, your laptops. But not only that, you'll find us on the new smart TV. So when you go to open up your App Store and your new smart TV, we can also be found in amongst Netflix and Stan.
That was Tangora Hanaki from Nagata Media speaking to The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakira coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company. And we'll see you next time on The Wire.